decision by turning to the United Nations for a deployment of its peacekeeping force. It was a bit of a ruse, since American soldiers comprised 85% of this force. The ruse was compounded when the Security Council voted to approve the deployment, even though the war could have been prevented if the Soviets had exercised their veto. But the Soviets were not present at the critical meeting. Instead, they had staged a walkout in protest of the UN's refusal to provide a seat in its General Assembly for Red China. The Soviet mystery. Why would the Soviets opt to pass up an opportunity to protect their surrogate operation in North Korea? Was a blunder of this magnitude really intentional? These questions have dogged historians for decades. The answers may be discovered by following the money. By 1927, Rockefeller owned Standard Oil of New York, and its subsidiary, the Vacuum Oil Company, had purchased the Russian oil fields and constructed a massive refinery in Batumi, on the coast of the Black Sea. In accordance with the deal, the Rockefellers gained the right to market Soviet oil in Europe, while the Bolsheviks received a loan of $75 million. During the same time, Rockefeller-owned Chase National Bank had established the American-Russian Chamber of Commerce, which financed Soviet raw material exports and sold Soviet bonds in the United States. In 1935, Stalin expropriated many foreign investments in Russia, but the holdings of the House of Rockefeller were not touched. Other Rockefeller investments were made in the Soviet Union, including the construction of a truck factory that created tanks and rocket launchers. The total holdings of Chase National, Standard Oil, the Guaranty Trust Company, and other firms controlled or owned by the Rockefellers remained concealed from public scrutiny. The profits from these enterprises flowed into numbered accounts at Swiss banks so that they could never be audited by American legislators or U.S. Treasury officials. It was all a matter of high finance. The creation of another superpower by the House of Rockefeller proved to be an incredibly profitable venture. The Soviet Union began producing T-34/85 tanks and MiG-15 fighter jets for the North Korean army with financing from the House of Rockefeller. The war boom. The Korean War also produced a windfall for the American holdings of the money cartel, including the Rockefeller family. It necessitated, as John White Clay Chambers writes in the Oxford Companion to American Military History, a permanent military-industrial establishment in peacetime, as well as wartime, or, at least, in cold as well as hot war. Since the war mandated a quadrupling in military spending, the fortunes of the Rockefellers and the other global banking families increased exponentially. The Rockefellers had heavily invested in Boeing, McDonnell Aircraft, and other leading firms that received lucrative contracts with the Department of Defense. In addition to its oil companies, Exxon, Mobil, Texaco, Atlantic Richfield, Standard Oil of California, Standard Oil of Indiana, and Marathon, the family had acquired majority control in steel companies, Inland Steel, Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel, and National Steel, and chemical companies, Merck, Pfizer, and Wyeth, all of which reaped enormous profits from the so-called police action. International Harvester, the Rockefeller-owned agricultural equipment company, emerged as one of the country's leading defense contractors by producing aerial torpedoes, military bulldozers, M7 tanks, 37mm cannon shells, 57mm anti-tank guns, aircraft cannons, and other munitions. An extra bonus to these earnings was the remilitarization of Japan, which not only forced the Rockefeller-owned firms to go into overdrive, but also gave rise to the Rockefeller-dominated Nippon Oil and Energy. The war was particularly ugly. The UN strategy involved the mass killing of civilians through extensive bombings. On August 12th, the U.S. Air Force dropped 626 tons of bombs on North Korea. 2 weeks later, the daily tonnage increased to 800 tons. The carpet bombings resulted in the destruction of 78 cities and thousands of villages. By the time an armistice was signed on July 27, 1953, a third of the population of North Korea, over 3 million people, had been wiped out. The official U.S. casualty list showed that 36,914 American soldiers had died in the conflict, and 7,800 remained unaccounted for. The struggle resulted neither in territorial gain or loss. The objective of the war had been containment, not liberation or victory. The terms of the armistice called for the creation of a demilitarized zone, DMZ, between North and South Korea. Each side was to be 2,200 yards from the center. The DMZ was to be patrolled by both sides at all times. And so it had come to this. America's wars were to be waged with limited rules of engagement and indefinite outcomes to advance the purpose of the global bankers, who had brought the United Nations into being. Despite the military failure of the Korean War, the CFR continued its campaign for more and more power to be granted to the United Nations, including the institution of a permanent force to police the planet. In Freedom from War, the United States Program for General and Complete Disarmament in a Peaceful World, a publication from the U.S. State Department, Dean Rusk, and other CFR members called for the transference of all tactical and strategic military weapons to the United States. Draftees of this document argued universal peace could only be achieved by this means. They overlooked the fact that the majority of the UN member nations were dictatorships with deep-seated repugnance for constitutional republics, and that the gatherings of the General Assembly were characterized by rabid anti-American rants. Lucifer's Reemergence. The planners of the New World Order, including Rhodes and Nathan Rothschild, were intensely interested in the occult, an interest that gave rise to the Society of Psychic Research and the Theosophist movement. Their obsession was shared by their disciples, including the founders of the United Nations. Lucis Trust became an official consultative agency of the UN and its publishing arm. Founded in 1922 as the Lucifer Publishing Company by Alice Bailey, a disciple of Helena Petrova Blavatsky, the chartered purpose of the trust was as follows. To encourage the study of comparative religion, philosophy, science, and art. To encourage every line of thought tending to the broadening of human sympathies and interests, and the expansion of ethical, religious, and educational literature. To assist or to engage in activities for the relief of suffering and for human betterment, and in general, to further worthy efforts for humanitarian and educational ends. The leading sponsors of Lucis Trust included Henry Clausen, Supreme Grand Commander of the Supreme Council, 33rd degree, Southern District, Scottish Rite, John D. Rockefeller IV, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Marshall Field Family, World Bank President Robert McNamara, U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, and IBM President Thomas Watson, Under Secretary of State Alexis Johnson, and the United Theosophists of New York City. Bailey's ultimate objective in establishing Lucis Trust was to bring about a one-world religion under the guiding light of Lucifer. She wrote, "The day is dawning when all religions will be regarded as emanating from one spiritual source. All will be seen as unitedly providing the one root out of which the universal religion will inevitably emerge." In keeping with this objective, the Trust established World Goodwill, an agency within the UN that seeks to harness the spiritual qualities of human beings in order to issue forth a new era of enlightenment. Signatories to the World Goodwill document included Helmut Schmidt, former Chancellor of West Germany, Malcolm Fraser, former Australian Prime Minister, Oscar Arias Sanchez, former Prime Minister of Costa Rica, Israeli President Shimon Peres, Robert McNamara, Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, and Jimmy Carter. Aside from Lucis Trust and World Goodwill, The scent of sulfur could also be discerned in the creation of the UN's two evil sisters, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. 26. The Evil Sisters.
Just between you and me, shouldn't the World Bank be encouraging more migration of the dirty industries to the LDCs, less developed countries? I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. I've always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted. Their air quality is probably vastly inefficiently low compared to Los Angeles or Mexico City. The concern over an agent that causes a 1 in a million change in the odds of prostate cancer is obviously going to be much higher in a country where people survive to get prostate cancer than in a country where under 5 mortality is 200 per thousand. The problem with the arguments against all of these proposals for more pollution in LDCs, intrinsic rights to certain goods, moral reasons, social concerns, lack of adequate markets, etc., could be turned around and used more or less effectively against every bank proposal for liberalization.
Lawrence H. Summers, chief economist of the World Bank, in an internal memo dated December 12, 1991, Summers went on to become the U.S. Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration and president of Harvard University. In addition to the United Nations, the Council on Foreign Relations, through its War and Peace Studies Project, also spawned the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank. The Articles of Agreement for these organizations were drawn up at an international conference of 44 allied countries at the Mount Washington Hotel and Resort in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. The agreement which brought the two sisters to life was ratified on December 27, 1945. According to A.K. Chesterton,
"The World Bank and the IMF were not incubated by hard-pressed governments engaged in waging war, but by a supranational money power, which could afford to look ahead to the shaping of a post-war world that would serve its interests."
The IMF, with headquarters in Washington, D.C., was set up to control international exchange rates and to stabilize currencies. The funding for the organization was based on a quota system, with the most industrialized countries providing the greatest share of revenue. But the lion's share, over 20%, came from the United States, since the currencies of other countries were not transferable into gold. FDR had confiscated the gold of the American citizenry and removed the nation from the gold standard. But everybody else in the world could still exchange their paper dollars for gold at the fixed price of $35 per ounce. The result of this arrangement was the ongoing transference of America's wealth to overseas banks, and the recognition of the dollar as the basis of the global economy. A goal beyond gold. As long as the dollar remained redeemable in gold, the amount of currency that could be created by the money cartel in charge of the IMF remained limited. John Maynard Keynes, the leading British economist at the Bretton Woods Conference, recognized this problem as soon as the IMF was established. He wrote,
"I felt that the leading central bank would never voluntarily relinquish the then existing forms of the gold standard, and I did not desire a catastrophe sufficiently violent to shake them off involuntarily. The only practical hope lay in a gradual evolution in the forms of a managed world currency, taking the existing gold standard as a starting point."
The ultimate goal of the group who gathered at Bretton Woods was the creation of a world currency called the Bancor. At the conference, Mariner Eccles, a governor of the Federal Reserve Board, noted, "An international currency is synonymous with international government, but this act, which would have driven the final nail in Uncle Sam's coffin, proved to be even too radical for acceptance by the American dignitaries in attendance, including Harry Morgenthau, Jr." the special drawing rights. The plan to wean the world from gold came to fruition on August 15, 1971, when President Richard Nixon signed an executive order declaring that the United States no longer would redeem its paper dollars for gold. Nixon was acting on the advice of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, a lifelong appendage of the Rockefeller interests, and budget advisor George Shultz, later Secretary of State and chairman of the vast Bechtel construction giant. Thanks to Nixon's executive order, the IMF now could function as the world's central bank by providing an unlimited issue of its own fiat currency to member nations. This new money, based solely on the money cartel's statement of its worth, was called a special drawing right, SDR. It operated, as economist Dennis Turner explains, in the following way.
SDRs are turned into loans to third world nations by the creation of checking accounts in the commercial or central banks of the members in the name of debtor governments. These bank accounts are created out of thin air. The IMF creates dollars, francs, pounds, or other hard currencies and gives them to a third world dictator, with inflation resulting in the country where the currency originated. Inflation is caused in the industrialized nations while wealth is transferred from the general public to the debtor nation, and the debtor nation doesn't repay.
But the sword is two-edged. Nations borrow SDRs primarily to pay interest on their mounting debts. This would be fine and dandy, save for the fact that the IMF charges interest on every SDR that it produces from its computer system. And so, the loans, for the most part, do not serve to bolster failing economies. They simply create a steady flow of wealth from borrowing nations to the money changers who control the IMF and are not subjected to any international supervision. The dollar's demise. The dollar, severed from the gold standard, ceased to serve as the official IMF currency and was compelled to compete with other currencies, primarily the mark and the yen, on its relative value to the currencies. Over the decades, the dollar became increasingly discounted. Still and all, it remained a favored medium of exchange, since America as a country remained wide open to foreign investors, who could buy American real estate, American factories and industrial plants, American mining companies and shopping centers, without the restrictions placed on such purchases by other nations. For this reason, the Federal Reserve continued to churn out massive amounts of fiat paper money, since the demand for such dollars seemed to be endless. This situation permitted Americans to finance its enormous trade deficits with more and more money made out of nothing, and allowed them to purchase cars, cell phones, computers, clothing, generic drugs, and 70-inch high-definition television sets at cut-rate prices, while the foreign manufacturers got the greenbacks. By the 21st century, this flood of dollars, which continued to be discounted, caused inflation to raise its hoary head until America was rapidly approaching the time when foreign manufacturers no longer will accept dollars for their goods, and the Federal Reserve no longer will be able to finance its enormous trade deficit by churning out paper money. The good old days are gone. At the end of 2016, the U.S. trade deficit stood at $502 billion. This prompted the following response from Chinese officials. The U.S. government has come to terms with the painful fact that the good old days when it could just borrow its way out of messes of its own making are finally gone. China, the sole superpower's largest creditor, now has every right to demand that America address its structural debt problem and ensure the security of China's dollar-denominated assets. The officials went on to demand that the Federal Reserve be placed under restraints and subjected to international monitoring. International supervision over the issue of U.S. dollars should be introduced, and a new, stable, and secured global currency may also be an option to avert a catastrophe caused by any single country. The second sister. While the IMF purportedly provides loans to stabilize economies, the World Bank, which was set up with funds from Morgan Stanley and First Boston, another J.P. Morgan facility, shelled out loans to war-ravaged and underdeveloped nations. Through the years, the majority of the presidents of the World Bank have come from the stables of the Council on Foreign Relations. Eugene Meyer, the first president of the World Bank, 1945, was a CFR official and the former chairman of the Federal Reserve. He was succeeded by John J. McCloy, 1947 to 1949, who also served as the CFR chairman. All of these men had strong ties to Wall Street. McCloy was a partner of the Wall Street corporate law firm of Milbank, Tweed, Hope, Hadley & McCloy, which had long served the Rockefeller family and the Chase Bank as legal counsel. From there, he moved to become chairman of the board of the Chase Manhattan Bank, a director of the Rockefeller Foundation, and of Rockefeller Center. Eugene Black, who replaced McCoy, was a senior vice president at Chase Manhattan, and his son, Bill, was a Morgan Stanley executive. The House of Morgan looked on the World Bank as its greatest creation. It represented the crystallization of the family's efforts, beginning with the Pilgrim Society and the Federal Reserve, to acquire, along with the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, ultimate control over the world's financial systems. The World Bank established its headquarters in Washington, D.C. Its membership consisted of the same 44 nations that belonged to the IMF. Like its sister agency, it was controlled by $1, one vote, rather than the one country, one vote UN system. Since the United States provided nearly 20% of the money required to fund the World Bank, the New York bankers, Morgan, Rockefeller, and Kuhn Loeb, gained a permanent place among the bank's executive directors and the exclusive right to appoint the bank president. Ostensibly, this Morgan creation was supposed to serve as the savior of mankind by enabling foreign governments to provide care for those most in need. The loans were provided on generous terms, usually at rates below market, and for durations as long as 50 years. The lion's share of the cash, which amounted to $30 billion, came from the U.S. taxpayers. Terms and conditions. But there is a snare to the World Bank's every transaction. The money, like IMF loans, is provided with very exacting conditions known as structural adjustment programs, SAPs. One SAP is the immediate reimbursement to the country's creditors, such as Morgan Stanley, Chase Manhattan, and Citibank. Another is the country's agreement to sell off its key assets, including their water supply, their pipelines, and their power systems, to buyers provided by the World Bank, IMF. A third condition is the country's commitment to take remedial steps, including a restructuring of its government and the resettlement of populations, dictated by World Bank IMF officials. The SAPs have caused devastating results for countries who accepted the loans. The World Bank IMF forced Argentina and Ecuador to liquidate its public holdings in order to comply with the repayment demands. In this way, Rockefeller-affiliated Citibank seized control of 50% of Argentina's banks. Rockefeller-owned British Petroleum assumed ownership of Ecuador's pipelines, and Enron, a shell company tied to the House of Rothschild, obtained control of the Great Lakes that provide water to Buenos Aires. Cry the beloved country. Other SAPs mandates include the lowering of existing wages, the raising of the interest rate, the downsizing of all state facilities, the phasing out of statutory minimal wages, and the termination of surplus teachers and healthcare workers. In extreme circumstances, even the resettlement of existing populations is required. Such a program got underway in Tanzania, which has received more aid per capita from the World Bank than any other country. Thousands of Tanzanians were driven from their villages, which were set ablaze, and loaded like cattle into trucks for relocation in government villages. On average, third world countries face as many as 67 conditions for every World Bank loan. Some countries are hit with a far higher number of demands. Uganda, for example, where 23% of all children under 5 are malnourished, faced a staggering 197 conditions attached to its World Bank Development Finance grant in 2005. Anxious to uphold the conditions, Ugandan security forces engaged in mass detentions, torture, and the killing of hundreds of prisoners. The fruits of Cecil Rhodes. Zimbabwe, formerly known as Rhodesia in honor of Cecil Rhodes, serves as a prime example of the effects of SAPs on a third world economy. In accordance with stipulations from the IMF World Bank, the leftist government confiscated and nationalized many of the farms that were owned by white settlers. The most desirable properties became occupied by leading government officials, while the least desirable farms were transformed into state-run collectives. The collectives were such miserable failures that the natives who worked the farms were forced to beg for food. By 1992, 1 year after Zimbabwe became subjected to the IMF World Bank, the economy went into a deep recession. The GDP fell by nearly 8%. 25% of the public workers were laid off, and unemployment began to soar, reaching 50% in 1997. By 1999, 68% of the population was living on less than $2 a day. The per capita budget for health care fell from $22 in 1990 to $11 in 1996, causing a 30% decline in the quality of medical services. Twice as many women were dying of childbirth in Harare hospitals in 1993 than in 1990. By 1995, the number of cases of tuberculosis had quadrupled. At the dawn of the 21st century, one-fourth of Zimbabwe's population was infected with HIV/AIDS. According to a 3-year study released in 2002 by the Structural Adjustment Participatory Review International Network, SAPRIN, in collaboration with the World Bank, SAPs have been expanding poverty, inequality, and insecurity around the world. They have torn at the heart of economies and the social fabric, increasing tensions among different social strata, fueling extremist movements, and delegitimizing democratic political systems. Their effects, particularly on the poor, are so profound and pervasive that no amount of targeted social investments can begin to address the social crises that they have engendered. Anti-American animus. Since the World Bank and the IMF are located in Washington, D.C., and controlled by the houses of Morgan and Rockefeller, the people who have been subjected to SAPs manifest a strong anti-American animus. They assume that the twin banks are part of a corrupt capitalistic government that seeks to deprive them of life's basic necessities. Within 40 years of the creation of these sister organizations, violent riots directed against Americans and caused by the austerity programs erupted in Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, Egypt, Haiti, Liberia, Peru, and the Sudan. Concerning these occurrences, Luiz Inácio Silva, a prominent Brazilian politician, said,
"Without being radical or overly bold, I will tell you that the Third World War has already started. A silent war, not for that reason any the less sinister. This war is tearing down Brazil, Latin America, and practically all the Third World. Instead of soldiers dying, there are children. Instead of millions of wounded, there are millions of unemployed. Instead of destruction of bridges, there is the tearing down of factories, schools, hospitals, and entire economies. It is a war by the United States against the Latin American continent and the Third World. It is a war over the foreign debt, one which has as its main weapon interest, a weapon more deadly than the atom bomb, more shattering than a laser beam."
27. The Bastard Son.
Now, as nearly as I can make out, those fellows in the CIA don't just report on wars and the like. They go out and make their own, and there's nobody to keep track of what they're up to. They spend billions of dollars on stirring up trouble so they'll have something to report on. It's become a government all of its own and all secret. They don't have to account to anybody.
Harry Truman, interview with Merle Miller, 1962. On September 20th, 1945, President Harry S. Truman abolished the OSS and placed its secret intelligence and counter-espionage branches under the War Department as the Strategic Services Unit, SSU. Within months, the SSU morphed into the National Intelligence Authority and the Central Intelligence Group, CIG, the precursor of the CIA. According to Richard Helms in his memoirs, General Vandenberg, the director of CIG, recruited Alan Dulles, who had returned to his law practice in New York, to draft a proposal for the shape and organization of what would become the Central Intelligence Agency, from the outline of Wild Bill Donovan, who remained a close confidant to the houses of Rockefeller and Rothschild. The proposal met with Truman's approval. The Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, was created in 1947 under the National Security Act to carry out covert operations against hostile foreign states or groups, or in support of friendly foreign states or groups, but which are so planned and conducted that any U.S. government responsibility for them is not evident to unauthorized persons. True to the vision of General Wild Bill Donovan, the new agency was exempt from disclosure of its organization, functions, officials, titles, salaries, or numbers of personnel employed. Even its solicitation and distribution of funds was to be concealed from congressional and judicial scrutiny. As Tom Braden, a senior CIA operational official in the early 1950s, explained, "The agency never had to account for the money it spent, except to the president, if he wanted to know how much money it was spending. Otherwise, the funds were not only unaccountable, they were unvouchered, so there was really no means of checking them. Since it, the CIA, was unaccountable, it could hire as many people as it wanted. It could hire armies. It could buy banks." The ties between the new agency and the House of Rockefeller were apparent from the start. Top-secret planning meetings were held at the Pratt House, the CFR headquarters in New York. These meetings were chaired by Alan Dulles, who in 1947 remained a partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, the New York law firm that represented the Rockefeller business interests and served as the CFR president. The agency would serve the interests of the Rockefellers and the money cartel by toppling foreign governments, seizing natural resources, promoting free trade, and opening channels of communication between the world's central banks. In time, several of the CIA's covert operations, including MK Ultra, would be funded by the Rockefeller family and the Rockefeller Foundation. The CIA represented another chapter in the linear story of the development of a shadow government that sought to rule the world. It's a story that began with the teachings of Freemasonry and the creation of Rhodes's secret society, and continued with the formation of the Round Table Movement, the Federal Reserve, the CFR, and the UN. It was authored by the House of Rothschild and the banking families that became affiliated with it. Thanks to the Bank of International Settlements, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, these banking families gained global economic control, and with the CIA, they would attempt to obtain political hegemony. An elite agency. In keeping with OSS protocol, Dulles recruited agents for the new intelligence agency almost exclusively from the nation's elite, millionaire businessmen, Wall Street bankers and lawyers, members of the national news media and Ivy League scholars. The new recruits included Nelson Rockefeller, son of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., Tommy the Cork Corcoran, a former governor of the Federal Reserve, three Harvard-trained Wall Street lawyers, Richard Bissell, a Ford Foundation executive, William F. Buckley, Jr., a Yale graduate and son of a prominent oil baron, Philip Graham, a Harvard graduate and future owner of the Washington Post, William Colby, a graduate of Princeton and the Columbia Law School and grandson of Gates McGarrah, one of the world's wealthiest bankers, and Richard Mellon Scaife, the principal heir to the Mellon banking oil and aluminum fortune. Rear Admiral Roscoe H. Hillencoder of the ONI became the executive director and former OSS official. Wall Street lawyer Frank Wisner was appointed head of covert operations. Red Alert. The first concern of the new intelligence agency was the situation in Italy, where the Italian Communist Party, Partito Comunista Italiano, or PCI, was poised to take control of the government. Between late 1943 and mid-1944, the PCI had doubled, and in the German-occupied northern half of the country, an extremely radical Marxist movement was gathering strength. In the winter of 1944, over 500,000 Turin workers, waving the red flag, shut down the factories for 8 days, despite brutal Gestapo repression, and the Italian underground, consisting of communist sympathizers, grew to 150,000 armed men. Post-war Italy stood poised to become the first communist country in Western Europe. Hundreds of thousands of Northerners had either actively supported or actively fought for the partisan movement that had finally forced the German army out of Italy. It was the partisans who had captured Mussolini and who had hung him upside down with his mistress. It was the partisans who continued to assassinate fascists after the war ended, and it was the partisans who constituted the PCI. By 1946, the division in the country became acute, with the people in the north wanting a communist republic and the people in the south wanting a Catholic monarchy. In Sicily, the rise of the PCI was even more disconcerting. Girolamo Licausi, the island's leading communist, stirred up the masses with his demands for the redistribution of the land's feudal holdings. His words, "We plan no Soviet rule here, cut no ice with the mob and the propertied classes, but revitalize the longings of the landless poor for economic reform." In 1947, the left, never previously strong in Sicily, skyrocketed out of nowhere. All of Italy was stunned by the provincial elections, which produced resounding victories for the communists. With national elections in Italy scheduled for 1948, U.S. officials were faced with the specter of a coalition coming to power under Palmiro Togliatti, who had sat out the war under the hospitality of the Kremlin. The first numbered document of the newly created CIA was a top-secret report entitled The Position of the United States with Respect to Italy, NSC 1/1. The report, which was issued on November 14, 1947, contained the following quote from a cable sent by George Kennan, director of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff. "As far as Europe is concerned, Italy is obviously the key point. If communists were to win election there, our whole position in the Mediterranean and possibly Western Europe as well would probably be undermined." The dirty money. The heightened paranoia over the possibility of a PCI victory gave rise to the creation of the Office of Policy Coordination within the new intelligence agency. This office was authorized to engage in paramilitary operations as well as political and economic warfare. The authorization for such covert action, according to CIA Director Frank Wisner, was included in a catch-all clause to the National Security Act of 1947, which granted the CIA the right to engage in functions related to intelligence affecting the national security. And nothing in 1947 seemed more of a threat to the peace and stability of America and the Western world than the threat of the communist takeover of Italy. In the eyes of Wisner, Dulles, Donovan, and Angleton, the only individuals with the means to ward off this nightmare were Lucky Luciano and Calogero Vizzini, Don Calo, the capo di tutti capi, boss of bosses of the Sicilian mafia, who had been jailed by Mussolini for his support of the Christian Democrats and his opposition to fascism. The new intelligence agency, thanks to Paul E. Helliwell and the creation of the global heroin industry, now had a steady supply of cash to pay them. Of course, the money for the muscle could not be paid to Lucky and the Don Calo clan directly. It had to be channeled through a financial firm that would not be subjected to scrutiny by U.S. Treasury agents, Italian bank examiners, or international fiscal monitors. Only one institution possessed such immunity, and it was located in the heart of Vatican City. Cash and candy. In the months before the 1948 national election, the CIA dumped $65 million of its black money into the Vatican Bank. Much of the cash was hand-delivered in large suitcases by members of Luciano's syndicate, including clerics with affiliations to the Sicilian Mafia. The reception of this money by the Holy See was held in strictest confidentiality. One reason for the secrecy, as Cardinal Francis Spellman of New York later revealed, was that
subversive groups in the United States would grasp this as a very effective pretense for attacking the United States government for having released money to the Vatican, even though indirectly conveyed.
The heroin, which remained the source for the black money, continued to be supplied to the Sicilian mob by Schiaparelli, the Italian pharmaceutical giant. The dope was received by a chain of bogus businesses that had been set up in Palermo by Luciano and Don Carlo. These businesses included a candy factory which produced chocolates that were filled with neither cherries nor cream, but nuggets of 100% pure smack. Another company was a fruit export enterprise, which was of integral importance since the drugs continued to be shipped to the United States with the cooperation of the CIA in crates of oranges, half of which were made of wax and stuffed with pure heroin. Italian election tactics. In the closing months of 1947, hundreds of made men began to arrive in Italy from New York, Chicago, and Miami to aid Luciano and Don Carlo in addressing the communist problem. Several, including Silvestro Sam Carolla, arrived on U.S. military transports. The CIA's black money for mob muscle was shelled out by the Vatican Bank from ecclesiastical organizations, including Catholic Action. In this way, the Holy See forged an alliance with the Sicilian Mafia, an alliance that would strengthen throughout the next three decades. Murder, Inc. was now unleashed upon the Italian electorate. Don Carlo and an army of thugs, including Vito Genovese's cousin Giovanni Genovese, burned down 11 communist branch offices and made 4 assassination attempts on communist leader Girolamo Licausi. The gang under Frank Coppola, who had been imported from Detroit by Angleton to work with Sicilian bandit Salvatore Giuliano, also opened fire on a crowd of workers celebrating May Day in Portella della Ginestra, killing 11 and wounding 57. The funds for the massacre were provided by Wild Bill Donovan through his World Commerce Corporation. One of Italy's leading labor organizers, Placido Rizzotto, was found dead at the bottom of a cliff, legs and arms chained and a bullet through his brain. Throughout 1948, in Sicily alone, the CIA-backed terror attacks resulted in the killing, on average, of 5 people a week. The Vatican Death Squad. In addition to the undertakings of Murder, Inc., Monsignor Don Giuseppe Bicchierai, acting upon papal authority, assembled a terror gang charged with the task of beating up communist candidates, smashing left-wing political gatherings, and intimidating voters. The money, guns, and jeeps for the Monsignor's terror attacks were furnished by the CIA from surplus World War II stockpiles. On election day, Don Carlo and his thugs stuffed ballot boxes and bribed voters with gifts of freshly laundered drug money, while Pope Pius remained within his chambers, hunched up, almost physically overcome by the weight of his present burden. The mob's tactics worked, and the Christian Democrats triumphantly returned to power. In his memoirs, William Colby, who would later become the CIA director, wrote that the communists would have gained 60% of the vote without the agency's sabotage. Other Catholic banks. 1 year after the election, renewed fears of a communist takeover of Italy arose from Stalin's creation of the Comecon, the Union of the Soviet Union, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, and Romania, to enforce the Soviet dominion of the lesser states of Central Europe. In the face of this development, the CIA opted to extend support for the Christian Democratic Party in Italy and stay behind units throughout Western Europe with billions in covert funding that could only come from the expansion of the drug trade. The CIA funds were deposited by members of Don Carlo's crime family in Catholic banks throughout Italy, including Banco Ambrosiano. These banks, thanks to the Lateran Treaty, were safe from scrutiny by the Bank of Italy and Italy's Treasury Department. A henchman for Genco Russo, Don Carlo's immediate successor as capo, now observed, "He, Russo, is constantly in contact with priests. Priests go to his place, and he goes to the bank, which is always run by priests. The bank director is a priest. The bank has always been the priest's affair." The Vatican Desk. In 1949, Pope Pius XII issued a solemn decree that excommunicated not only the members of the Holy Mother Church who joined or favored the Communist Party, but also all Catholics who read, published, or disseminated any printed material that upheld communist ideology. In an internal memo, the CIA provided the following analysis of the Pope's action.
By this action, the two most powerful organizations for moving men to act on behalf of a doctrine are brought into open and basic conflict. The possible long-range ramifications of this conflict cannot be easily or comprehensively defined. The decree will be a very powerful factor in the East-West struggle. In Eastern Europe, it implies a struggle to the bitter end. In many other areas of the world, the decree will exert a powerful and prolonged indirect pressure on both policy and action. Communist governments and communists generally will have to accept the issue as now posed. Although the communist governments would obviously have preferred to carry on their anti-church campaign at their own pace, the power of decision has now been taken from them. The conflict can be pressed on them with a speed and comprehensiveness that may well affect the satisfactory development of other communist policies.
Fearful that the decree might be insufficient to crush the forces of godliness, Pius XII persisted to tighten his ties with the CIA into a Gordian knot that no one could unravel. The Christian Democratic Party continued to receive more than $20 million in annual aid from the agency, and in return, the CIA established a Vatican Desk under Angleton. The Vatican Desk reviewed all of the intelligence reports that were sent to the Holy See from papal nuncios who were stationed behind the Iron Curtain for pertinent data. During the early years of the Cold War, this became one of the only means for the agency to penetrate the Eastern Bloc. Strategies between the CIA and the Church were drafted to undermine left-wing movements throughout Europe and South America. The affairs of politically suspect members of the Curia were monitored by moles. The actions of progressive priests, particularly in Latin America, were thwarted by strong-arm techniques. 28. Onslaught of Atrocities.
The Association for Responsible Dissent estimates that by 1987, 6 million people had died as a result of CIA covert operations. Former State Department official William Blum correctly calls this an American Holocaust. The CIA justifies these actions as part of its war against communism. But most coups do not involve a communist threat. Unlucky nations are targeted for a wide variety of reasons, not only threats to American business interests abroad, but also liberal or even moderate social reforms, political instability, the unwillingness of a leader to carry out Washington's dictates, and declarations of neutrality in the Cold War. Indeed, nothing has infuriated CIA directors quite like a nation's desire to stay out of the Cold War.
Steve Kangas, A Timeline of CIA Atrocities, 1994. Not wanting to be dependent on Schiaparelli, the Italian pharmaceutical giant, for the heroin to mount ongoing covert operations, the CIA worked with General Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang, KMT, army to create a drug route that would lead from Southeast Asia to the United States. By 1950, thousands of General Chiang's troops had been driven into the Shan states of Burma by the communist forces of Mao Zedong. The troops were mostly members of a Muslim minority known as the Hua, who were born and bred in southwestern Yunnan, an area dominated by the opium trade. With the hope that the reconstituted KMT, now known as the 93rd Division, might still mount an invasion of China to aid in the Korean conflict, the CIA provided for all the immediate needs of the exiled army. It was an expensive undertaking that could only be offset by cultivation of poppy fields within the mountainous regions of northern Burma and northeastern Laos. By 1951, the CIA began supplying arms and materiel to the KMT troops, whose sole activity was opium cultivation. This venture became the second example of the CIA conducting off-the-books foreign policy, with assets of which the American people and most elected officials remained completely unaware. The decisions concerning this policy were made within the Office of Policy Coordination by a very small group of elite intelligence officials whose parameters remained undefined. These officials served America's rising military-industrial complex, which relied on privatized military and intelligence contractors, international bankers, and even Washington's most highly organized lobbyists. The World Commerce Corporation. To expedite the arms for drugs venture in the Far East, Wild Bill Donovan resigned from the military to form the World Commerce Corporation, WCC, with a small group of very wealthy friends, including Nelson Rockefeller, Joseph C. Grew, nephew of J.P. Morgan, Alfred DuPont, and Charles Jocelyn Hambro, director of the Hambro's Bank, and the Bank of England, with close ties to the Morgan family. The firm, which was registered in Panama, employed mob figure Sonny Fasuli, a notorious drug dealer, to provide services to General Chiang's National Army. The primary function of the WCC was to buy and sell surplus U.S. weapons and munitions to foreign underworld groups, including the KMT and the Italian mafias. In exchange for the arms, the KMT provided the opium required to create the post-war intelligence agency. The opium was flown from the mountains of Burma and Laos by cargo air transport to Bangkok, where the planes were emptied and loaded with weapons for the return flight to the poppy fields. In Bangkok, General Phao Sriananda, Director General of Thailand's National Police, employed his officers to load the product on the freighters of a mysterious shipping company called Sea Supply, Inc., SSI, a CIA front run by Paul Helliwell, who now served as the Burmese consulate in Miami. In 1954, British Customs in Singapore stated that Bangkok had become the major center for opium trafficking in Southeast Asia. The traffic became so lucrative that Thailand abandoned its anti-opium campaign, which had been launched in 1948. Intelligence Subculture. General Phao developed a close friendship with Donovan, who became the U.S. ambassador to Thailand. Indeed, Wild Bill became so enthralled with Phao that he nominated the Thai general for a Legion of Merit award. Although he failed to capture the award, Phao, by 1953, had received $35 million in aid from the CIA, including gifts of several naval vessels and cargo planes to transport the drugs to Hong Kong, Singapore, and Marseille. The benefactions were granted with the expectation that the KMT would launch guerrilla raids into China. The WCC and Sea Supply, like Cargo Air Transport, CAT, emerged from a subculture within the intelligence community of extremely wealthy and well-connected lawyers and businessmen who, at the time, were not part of any official government agency. This subculture eventually would give rise to a network of banks, including the Bank of Credit and Finance International, and proprietary businesses, including the American International Assurance Company of CV Star, which were created to support and conceal the flow of money from the heroin trade. False flags and media control. As the Western world became increasingly inundated with heroin, the CIA, through spokesmen such as George White of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, FBN, placed the blame on Chairman Mao and the People's Republic of China, who were accused of orchestrating the movement of 200 to 400 tons of opium per year from Yunnan to Bangkok. The agency further presented General Fao, the linchpin in the Asian drug connection, as America's best hope in combating this drug menace. Such reports represented the first unfurling of a CIA false flag. Knowing the importance of issuing such false reports, the CIA, under Allen Dulles, initiated Operation Mockingbird in 1953. This operation consisted of the recruitment of leading journalists and editors to fabricate stories and to create smokescreens in order to cast the agency's agenda in a positive light. Among the news executives who took part in this undertaking were William Paley of the Columbia Broadcasting System, Henry Luce of Time, Inc., Arthur Hayes Sulzberger of the New York Times, Barry Bingham, Sr. of the Louisville Courier-Journal, and James Copley of the Copley News Service. Entire news organizations eventually became part of Mockingbird, including the American Broadcasting Company, the National Broadcasting Company, the Associated Press, United Press International, Reuters, Hearst Newspapers, Scripps Howard, Newsweek, the Mutual Broadcasting System, the Miami Herald, the Saturday Evening Post, and the New York Herald Tribune. With over 400 journalists now on the take, along with mainstream news outlets, the agency could operate without fear of exposure. And so, the atrocities began. 1953. In 1953, the CIA turned its attention to Tehran, when the Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh nationalized the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. By purchasing the services of Iranian journalists, military officers, and members of parliament, the agency was able to spread false reports that Mossadegh was Jewish and a communist. These reports caused the Warriors of Islam, a group of militant extremists, to stage riots throughout Tehran. Among the rioters was the Ayatollah Khomeini, Iran's future leader. After Mossadegh was arrested and tossed out of office, the CIA replaced him with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran. The oil industry was denationalized and the country's national treasure was handed over to companies owned or partially owned by the House of Rockefeller. Inspired by North Korea's brainwashing program, the CIA launched its own experiments on mind control in an operation known as MK-Ultra. The project involved giving massive infusions of hallucinogens, including LSD, to American subjects without their knowledge or against their will. Others were placed into electric dream states through insulin overdoses, experimental drugs, and electroshock therapy. Several subjects committed suicide. Others degenerated into a vegetative state. The ultimate goal was to create human machines who would act on command of the agency, even against their own conscience. Funded by the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations, MK-Ultra also included studies in means of controlling the thoughts of the American people by public relations, advertising, hypnosis, and other forms of suggestion. 1954. In Guatemala, the CIA overthrew the democratically elected Jacob Arbenz in a military coup. Arbenz threatened to nationalize the Rockefeller-owned United Fruit Company, in which CIA Director Allen Dulles was a shareholder. Arbenz was replaced with a series of right-wing dictators whose bloodthirsty policies would kill over 100,000 Guatemalans in the next 40 years. 1956. Radio Free Europe, a CIA propaganda outlet, incited Hungary to revolt by broadcasting Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech, in which he denounced his predecessor, Joseph Stalin. The broadcast offered assurance that the American military would support the Hungarian uprising. The support never materialized as Hungarians launched a doomed armed revolt, which precipitated a major Soviet invasion. The conflict resulted in the deaths of 7,000 Soviets and 30,000 Hungarians. The propaganda spewed from Radio Free Europe was so blatantly false that it was illegal to publish transcripts of the broadcasts in the United States. 1959. With the assistance of the U.S. military, Papa Doc Duvalier became dictator of Haiti. He created his own private